When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
Okay, hello and welcome to an all-new episode of Safety FM with Jay Allen. Now listen, I'm going to tell you, I'm recording the introduction back in the studio in Orlando, but this right here is going to be a presentation based on some of the stuff that I saw at Energy Safety Canada's conference that took place last week in Banff. So we're going to sit back, we're going to listen to some presentations, and then we're going to do an interview with most of the participants right after they do their presentation to do some follow-up questions of maybe of some things that they were not able to do during their presentations themselves. Now, I'm going to tell you, as we are starting down this series of events, number one, I would like to thank Energy Safety Canada for allowing me to broadcast from the location, but also some of the information that was provided during this conference is just quite amazing. This particular presentation that we're about to play right now is called Choices and Consequences, Surviving Piper Alpha. Steve Ray, as he shares his experience from Piper Alpha incident and discusses valuable lessons for anyone working in high-risk environments. Discover how our work-related choices can shape safety culture on the site and the understanding the impact of your contributions to your overall safety. So let's go ahead and get started right now. Steve Ray will go through the whole thing, and then at the very end, I'll come right back and we'll pick up where we left off in regards of information and sitting down with Steve Ray and just having a brief discussion about what occurred during the Piper Alpha event.
Wow. How do you follow, Vanita? It's already a very emotional afternoon, and I can guarantee you it's going to get slightly more emotional. But before I get into my full presentation, I just want to take a minute or so to share a couple of things with you. In being invited to come to this amazing venue, I didn't really appreciate how beautiful and surreal it was until I got here, with the snow-capped mountains, the blue skies. And then it dawned on me, as it's done many times before, had I not survived the 6th of July 1988, I would have never had such experiences. So it does get emotional for me, and I cherish every second I've been here. As Vanita said, I'm a survivor of Piper Alpha, but I can tell you, for about 10 years post-Piper, I didn't want to be associated with it. As a young 26-year-old man, you really wouldn't want to be known as unemployable because you've broken. But I chose to continue in the business. And I went on and grew my career to manage operations internationally at a very senior level. And that's when I truly realized that my experience was extremely applicable at all levels of an industry. Whether you work onshore, in supply chain, production, drilling, matters not. You can all make a difference if you choose to. It's all about choices and consequences. So I'm going to do a couple of small exercises because I've been sitting long enough. If you're 45 years of age, and younger, please stand up. I'm not ageist, but it's good to see you all. The reason I do this is because you folks that are standing up now will not know Piper Alpha or anything of it firsthand. What you know, you would have read, Googled, or been told by a colleague. I will tell you a story about how it really was. And I know you will go home and share that story with your families. Now I want the remainder of you to stand up in the essence of equality. Please stand up if you can. I want you to take a brief look around you. Don't get to know the people beside you, just recognise their faces. It's important because we're all in a shared community. Right now we have created a culture in this room that will leave with it, and you will go into different cultures as you go back to your own networks, groups, places of life, etc. The next thing I'm going to ask you to do is, if you have a sticker, a small white sticker with a cross on it, on your seat, please remain standing. If you don't have a sticker, please sit down. And I know you're all thinking he's going to ask me questions. I'm not. I want you to appreciate how many people are not standing. Piper Alpha, in the space of 3.5 hours, as long as we will be in this room this afternoon, of the 100% of people, the 225 souls that went to work that day, only 27 would return home that next day. From a percentage perspective, that's as few people that are standing now against the whole backdrop of this room. Imagine, if you possibly can, losing those that are sitting down right now within 3.5 hours. Thank you. You may sit down. I'm going to open my presentation with a small explanation. I'm not only a co-director with my wife sitting at that table of Fortitude, Action Beyond Compliance, I'm also a chairman of the Pound for Piper Trust that raises funds for the legacy and upkeep of a beautiful garden in Aberdeen, dedicated to those that lost their lives that last night. I hold a memorial service with my trustees every year, and family, relatives, colleagues and friends from those lost still attend 37 years on. Grief never leaves us until we choose to leave. I want you to think about that as we go through my presentation. I want you to think about that as you look after one another at work and make conscious choices. I'm going to open properly now with a short video. Imagine, if you possibly can, being on board this installation, fighting for your life. I can tell you it's not a pleasant experience.
Nimrod 01 to Maritime Rescue.
Maritime Rescue to Nimrod 01. Go ahead, Nimrod.
Overhead Piper fuel platform now.
What's the situation?
It's an absolute bloody disaster. Dead smoke and flames. Huge flames.
What's the platform status?
Virtually nothing. Main platform structure not visible above the surface. We estimate flames to be 600 feet high.
Repeat, please, Nimrod.
You heard correctly. Flames estimated at 600 feet. Looks like a really big one.
...226 people just went to work that night. For many, for most of us, it was just another work day. By midnight, 167 would have lost their lives. Not because of something they did, but because of something that was happening since 1973, when the Piper field was first discovered by Occidental. There had been decisions made since that very day that would affect what happened on the 6th of July 1988. So many, many years later, Piper Alpha didn't happen just as a result of something on the 6th of July 1988. It started happening many years before. And that's what I want you to think about. In this world we live in, we are typically free to choose, but we're never free from the consequences of our choices. And in particular, in work environments, we make choices every day, some under pressure, cost, time, schedule. Some because we just feel a bit complacent that day. Some because we have too many on our desks or they are routine. They all have consequences. I want you to remember how you feel when you leave this room, when you make your next choice. You may make them differently. I'm also going to talk about six C's. And these six C's I came upon as a result of a significant research project. A research project into industrial accidents and incidents. These six C's you see on the slide were identified as causal factors that appeared after root cause analysis in most, if not all, the incidents that have ever occurred, whether they be minor, major, or catastrophic. Perhaps just one, communication, maybe change management. For the larger of these incidents and catastrophic disasters, there'll be a failing in every one of these six C's. I made it my business to identify what good looked like, what it really looked like to manage those six C's in a manner that would honour their integrity. This is my text in the purple writing. Feel free to copy this or ask for a copy, you can have it. I would suggest that your safety culture, your company, your work site, even on your shift, depends on how you manage these six C's. And they're not easy to manage. I will use them to demonstrate some of the things that went wrong and were causal in the Piper Alpha disaster for the first explosion and those that were catastrophic that followed. Please give them some thought and we will revisit them later on. I'm going to talk about my early years experience offshore. Because I can tell you, as a young boy in Aberdeen in the early 80s, late 70s, I was just so excited by what was going on in our town, in our city. I wanted to be part of it. I couldn't wait to get offshore. My colleagues, my friends were all the same. So as a young qualified technician, electrical technician, I decided to find work. I made a conscious choice. I gave up a well-paid staff job with all the benefits, the pension, the medical cover, and I took up a contracting job where I only got paid for the days I worked. Such was my desire to get offshore. I did so for about 5 years. There's a selection of installations that I visited during my time as a contractor, and those are not the only ones. I visited 25 approximately different installations in the space of 4 to 5 years, working as many days as they would allow me, making a significant amount of money for a young, driven individual. What that allowed me to have was a perspective on how many of the largest corporations in the business worked, from Shell to BP to Marathon to Amoco. And I can tell you, no one did it the same. Some did it well, some did it to compliance, and some chose to treat it laissez-faire as a thing they had to do just to operate. It left me with the feeling that if I was going to keep myself safe offshore, it mattered about what I did and what I thought, not the others. And I took that belief with me as I moved on through my career. And in 1985, I was offered a position on the North Alwyn, one of the larger installations in the North Sea. It was brand new. The people that arrived on the same helicopter as me were doing the first trip. It had no culture. It had no history. It was well built, well designed. Lessons had been learned. Choices had been made about how it was laid out. It was a particularly safe installation. The production part, as you can see, is remote from the main platform. So when you went to your bed at night, at least you could sleep in the comfort of knowing if there was a production below out on the production side, you would be safe. I was told when I moved on to the drilling side of the business on Alwyn, I could be there for 30 years. It could be my job for my working life. I would never be a staff person because they were always going to employ contractors on the drilling side. I had a conscious choice to make because I had. My girlfriend at the time and myself had become pregnant. We had responsibilities. We couldn't ski and play golf and drink all day anymore. So we had some conscious choices to make. I chose to leave this 30-year promise. I made that conscious decision. I took a staff position with one of the best contractors in the North Sea at the time, a company called Borden Drilling. They had operations in Canada, Australia. They were a great company. The choice I made was conscious. The consequences were pretty good. I picked up pension, I picked up medical cover. The flight was only 15 minutes from the shore. I had reduced my biggest exposure considerably because I always saw flying as my biggest exposure. The downside was it was pretty rickety. I could live with that. I had most of the things I wanted. They promised me 12 months at least on Beatrice Alpha. That was in January. Come April, I was transferred. I was transferred to Piper Alpha, April the same year. And I wasn't asked. I was now staff. I went where I was told. And I thought to myself, hey, can Piper be that different? It's just another installation. I'd never heard of it. I'd never visited it. How could it be that different? Let me assure you, I didn't have to be there long to know how different it was. There was a toxic culture. There were so many people on board doing so many different activities, from construction to drilling to diving to maintenance. It was a project. None of the crews really mixed. I was lucky I was part of a really tight drilling crew. We looked after one another. We did well. More importantly, we kept our heads down because we knew if we didn't, we would go. We would be let go because Occidental were pretty ruthless in how they managed their installation. That was Piper Alpha. Let me give you a brief history for those young sub-40 people. Occidental were going bankrupt. They had spent a huge amount of money in the North Sea and found not a drop of oil. With the second last well, they struck one of the biggest fields the North Sea will ever see, the Piper Field. 3 years later, just 3 years later, they had designed, constructed, and installed an offshore platform. We wouldn't get it off the drawing board in 3 years nowadays, but that's okay because we're doing it right. Occidental had cut some corners. They had used some second-hand equipment, some equipment that we wouldn't tolerate. But that was back in the day. So 2 years after it started producing, it was now the most productive platform this world had ever seen. It was producing 320,000 barrels of oil every single day. That is an enormous amount of production. It was confirmed as the most productive platform in the world. As it moved on, like most platforms do, production started to drop away. So they asked to make some modifications. They asked the UK government if they could make some modifications. In the 1978, they asked if they could bring in some more wells. They had designed an oil production platform. They did not produce gas at all. And the UK government said, we'll allow you to take in more oil wells, but you will have to start pumping your gas ashore. You can't flare it any longer. So they had to become not only an oil production platform, but a gas production platform. They had to find space for gas processing facilities. There wasn't any space. They removed a rig, they removed some modules, and they shoehorned, if I can, right in that middle part, they shoehorned a gas production process into the heart of that installation. They had some conscious choices to make. One was, do they replace the firewall with a blast wall? Because oil burns and gas explodes. That choice, a conscious choice, was that the firewall would do. They didn't need a blast wall. Very poor decision, it would prove wrong. Anyway, moving forward, once they'd made the changes, Piper was now not only still producing 145,000 barrels of liquids every day, it was now producing 94 million standard cubic feet of gas. Gas that had never been planned for. Gas that was highly explosive. This is how Piper was connected. Initially, it was an oil line all the way to Flotta in the island north of Scotland. 30-inch line, pumping all that oil. As they installed additional facilities, they hooked into the same line. And eventually, the blue lines were the gas lines. Not only was Piper producing its own gas, it was the pumping station for Tartan and Claymore, a facility it had never been planned. I show you this slide because I want you to think about the availability of hydrocarbons to Piper should anything go wrong. Significant. I've set the scene. I want to take you to my last day on Piper Alpha. I arrived at the heliport in the outskirts of Aberdeen City to board a helicopter with 16 of my crew, my buddies. It was just another crew change day. We boarded the helicopter and we flew the hour and 20 minutes out to Piper Alpha. We boarded, disembarked the helicopter on that very heliport, and we went down for our induction to be issued with our cabins where we would sleep for 2 weeks and to be told the priorities of what was going on in that installation that day. In fact, while we'd been away. Except on that day, we didn't really receive a safety induction. Occidental believed that if you'd been on Piper before and were core crew, you knew what you had to do. You knew where the safety facilities were. You knew how to muster. So they didn't do a safety induction. We were not told any of the activities that were going on that day, in particular the high potential activities. And the saddest part about all that induction, none of the 17 of us who had arrived on that day lifted our hands, asked the question. We were as implicit on what was going on in Piper and the culture as everyone else. We chose to go about our business without challenging the way it was. I was going on night shift. I went to my bed. But just before going to bed, I recognised by the change in sound, that Piper was flaring an enormous amount of gas. The whole platform was shaking. It was vibrating. And you would think that would be an alarm for you. This young individual chose to do nothing. It was not his business. I was in the business of looking after the drilling rig. Production wasn't my deal. I went to bed and I slept for a few hours. I got up around 5 p.m, had a bite to eat, and I went down to the maintenance office which was just, you can see I'm shaking here, just in that area there. And waiting for me in that maintenance office was Robert McCall, my relief, Douglas Finlay, our mechanic, and Sidney McBoyle, who I'd worked with before in another installation, who was the assistant mechanic. They were waiting for us night shift guys. We came in, it was our first shift. We had a bit of talk, we had a bit of banter. We greeted each other. And then we talked about what was going on. And I remember Robert McCall, who was my direct relief, saying to me, "Steve, the rig is running really well. There are no major maintenance works. There's been no breakdowns. You'll probably have a quiet night. And in fact, you might even get your head down for a couple of hours' sleep. I will see you in the morning." I would never see Robert, Douglas, or Sydney alive again. They were about to perish, and we had no idea. It was just another day at the office for us. They knocked off shift. I did some routine checks. I went up onto the drill floor, that white pointy bit for those that aren't too technical. This part, that was my domain. I was proud of what I did. I wanted to keep it running, keep it in good condition. I did all the routine checks, and Bob was right. There was nothing really much to do apart from take some readings and do some checks. 9 o'clock came. I went for my first tea break. I went back to the same maintenance office. I met with Ian Piper and John Goldthorpe, the other two members of the night shift maintenance crew on the drilling side. We talked about our time at home. We'd all came home that day. We'd all came on board that day. We shared some stories. We talked about our families. I talked about how scared I was about being a parent. All good fun. And we made an agreement that we would meet at midnight for our first evening meal on the rig. We stood up to go back to our business, and little did I know, I would never see Ian or John alive again. Within an hour, they would be fighting for their lives just as I would be, and we had no idea. I returned to the drill floor. I was working in a small space at the rear of the drill floor on the drilling facility with a couple of vendors when the first explosion happened. What they hadn't told us during the summer, during the induction, was that all these activities were ongoing on board the platform. In effect, the platform was going through the summer shutdown. Some of these tasks, for those that may not be too technical, are huge. They are significant. To be doing all these at the same time is only possible during a summer shutdown. I'm going to focus on two of these activities. The diving operations, believe it or not, and also the recertification campaign for the pressure relief valves. Not particularly the most dangerous of activities, but the most significant. And the interesting thing about that, it says it was a summer shutdown work scope. The platform crew had doubled in size. Half of them were living on a hotel floating by, and they would be transferred every day. So as you can see, a significant scope of work, except this year, Occidental had chosen not to shut down production. They had decided, consciously making a choice, to continue production while doing the summer shutdown, something they had not done in years. It meant there was an increase in opportunities for loss of containment. There was a huge increase in sources of ignition. There was a huge increase of people on board who didn't know the platform competence. And there was communication issues between all these varying different scopes. Here's where I was at 5 minutes to 10 on the 6th of July, 1988. Everything running as normal, our drill string running like clockwork. And then the first explosion occurred. Except for those on the drill floor, myself and eight of the drill crew, it didn't sound or feel like an explosion. It felt like someone had dropped something very heavy on the deck. Everything vibrated. The drill string wires swung about. The equipment shook and flung. All the books came off the shelves. All the tools came off the deck. And there was an eerie cloud of about 18 inches of dust coming out of the mats in the switch room. Such was the level of a vibration. What had just happened was the first explosion. But for us, it wasn't an explosion. We felt it was something different. The lights went out on the drill floor. There was no muster alarms. We'd lost all electrical power. That drill string that had been working so well was now hurtling towards the drill floor with a drill and drill string attached. There was about four or five people standing on the drill floor at that time, and we absolutely knew there was about to be a horrific collision. I remember watching my driller, Fred Busby, trying with all his might to apply the brake to try and stop it wiping us out, and eventually he did, and we all took a sigh of relief. We had survived our first life-threatening experience. This is what happened outside the drill floor, which we couldn't see. The first explosion. And I want you to focus on the thick black smoke. That smoke is all we could see from the opening on the drill floor. Completely contaminated with burning embers, thick black smoke you could not see through if you put your hand in front of you. And we knew we had to get to muster. And for us, muster was in the accommodation. Our supervisor arrived from the office, John Guttridge, and his first instruction was, we are abandoning the drill floor, something that drillers would never do. But here was a 25-year experienced tool pusher telling us we are leaving. What would leaving look like? We would make a human chain, because we knew where we were going. We would be blind. We lined up and we took each other by the collar and we prepared to make that intrepid journey to the muster point. John, our tool pusher, took us. He led us. We could not breathe. We could not see. But we trusted him. We made that choice. And as we approached the accommodation, the main door into the accommodation, we were all standing in a line. I was at the back. I'm tall. I could see the door just through the smoke. And that door was swinging wide open. All that smoke you see and burning embers was already flowing into the accommodation, our safe haven. It was compromised. That door had been in a state of disrepair since I first arrived on Piper in April. I, as well as everyone else on board that installation, had accepted that was the way it was, and accepted it made little difference. It was now being asked to do its job and was unable to do so. I couldn't bring myself to go inside the accommodation. I just couldn't bring myself to walk into that smoke-filled corridor. And I let go my colleague in front of me, and I watched as they all disappeared into the smoke. And I stood there thinking, I'm alone. I have no backup plan. I don't know Piper that well. What am I going to do? We'll come back to that in a minute. This was our intrepid journey. I'll show you our intrepid journey in a minute. But let's talk about what caused that first explosion. Commitment, one of the first and most important C's that we must all practice. Yet onshore management and offshore management had decided to continue production during a shutdown for all the summer shutdown activities. A complete failure of management complete failure in commitment, a conscious choice. Secondly, no one on that installation really knew the permit to work system. They had a full suite of documents, training manuals. Nobody used them. They had, over time, been replaced by an informal process of control of work. They had passed audit because audit had become complacent, and those doing the auditing were responsible for running the permit to work system. There was no real permit to work system. It was all about verbal exchanges, competence. There were two scopes of work, as I told you about. One for a relief valve, and there would be one for a pump, for pumping, let's call it, antifreeze into the pipe to stop ice forming. They were both on the same pipeline. No reference, cross-reference for either activity on the permit. Effectively, there were two separate operations with no common pipeline. An absolute lack of control of work. When they removed the relief valve, they had done so of about 150 over the last 4 weeks. They had become so familiar that they knew they could put a valve back in within 4 hours of having it pulled out and refitted. So they hadn't bothered tightening up the bolts and torquing them up. Because why bother? They were taking them out again within 4 hours. The pipe was depressurised. No good reason to torque up the valves and the bolts. So they had decided to hand tighten the bolts and leave them be. They didn't reinstall that valve within 4 hours that day. In fact, they didn't reinstall the valve any time that day. It was left out overnight. And because the permit to work system was so shoddy, they didn't communicate to anyone. As far as everyone else was concerned, that valve had went back in within 4 hours. But no one really knew. Communication failure. And as the standby pump, which was running, because pump A was being maintained, the standby pump failed, and they knew if they didn't get the pump back up and running, production would shut down. And production was king on Piper Alpha. The control room operators tried their best. They got to within 10 minutes of platform shutdown and decided, we have to start up the pump, it's shut down for maintenance. We haven't started the maintenance yet. They checked. They removed the lock off. They kicked in the pump. And the gas eventually reached the pipe and started escaping under pressure. 36 kilograms of gas escaped that night. That's all. That's not much. It's probably as much as you have at home for your barbecue or your motor trailer. Not a lot of gas. But it absolutely destroyed the guts of the platform. Go back to here. As I said, we were now standing at the accommodation. I had made my way across. We had believed that the helideck would be our primary means of escape. I could tell you there was no helicopter landing on there that night. Look at the smoke. Our secondary means of escape would be the lifeboats. The explosion had come up the back of the platform and completely ruined and destroyed two of the lifeboats. There would be no access or use of lifeboats that day, but we were still heading to them. Our journey took us along this route through the inferno that was Piper Alpha. I eventually decided I couldn't go in the accommodation. And believe it or not, the only thing I could think to do was to go back to where I came from. Running through the burning decks, the toxic smoke, unable to breathe, in a state of panic, I arrived back on the drill floor, which was relatively clear because it was completely enclosed, and I had no backup plan. I met my colleague Vince Wales, the Derrickman, and he hatched a plan because the Derrickman knows every stairway, access way and ladder on the installation, we decided we would have to leave by going into the water, and our only route would be how far we could get down the platform. It wasn't a straight line, let me tell you. Every corner we turned, we didn't have to make a conscious choice. The flames pushed us in the other direction. And before we got to our final destination, we found ourselves stuck in a corner like I'm standing here, inside the wind walls, with nowhere to go. We both accepted that that would be where we would perish. We were preparing to die. Vince remembered the hatch on the floor and the gratings. We managed to lift it and we went down a small 5-foot ladder. And lo and behold, we were out in the open, 70 feet above the water. Not much choices left, plenty consequences, but we had dodged another bullet. Vince was somewhat animated. I was a bit more calm because I didn't want to go in the water. I just kept thinking there must be another way. There was a further explosion. I turned around and Vince was gone. I didn't know if he'd been blown off or he'd jumped or whatever. He was just gone. As I stood there thinking, it's my turn. I put my hard hat down on the gratings. I kicked off my boots because I knew they would suck me under the water. And I emptied all the tools out of my pockets. And I prepared to jump 70 feet into the North Sea. I did so. And I can tell you, it took seconds to hit the water. And immediately you feel the pressure on your chest as you go deep from your 70 feet plunge. The water, the cold of the water in the North Sea is biting you as soon as you enter, and your lungs are aching for a breath. I kicked as hard as I could to come to the surface, and I popped up. And the first thing I thought was, nothing's broken. I've dodged a bullet. I only have to be picked up. No life jacket, just my coveralls. This will show you where I was. I was floating directly below the installation. And as I was gathering my breath, getting my breath back, there was a further huge explosion. A massive explosion. The tartan riser, that 18-inch pipe full of gas, had just had a full rupture at the 70-foot level. It was releasing 3 tons of gas every second. That gas cloud came rushing down towards the sea surface. And I thought once again, it's not my night. I'm going to be fried. I ducked under the water as deep as I could. I stayed there for, I don't know, 10 seconds maybe. I dared to come back up to the surface, and the gas had superheated or burned off. And that's exactly what I saw. I saw the start of a 600-foot flame as the gas erupted and rose with heat. And I dared once more to think, I'm going to make it. I dodged another bullet. I made another conscious choice to start swimming away from the installation in the hope I may be picked up. But what caused that second explosion to happen only 20 minutes after the first one? These pipelines are designed to give you at least an hour, 2 hours. Let's go back to the six seas. This is where that decision in 78 had proven to be a mistake. Management's commitment back in 78 to leave the firewall in had been absolutely fundamental to the second explosion. The first explosion, because it had no blast wall, had completely destroyed the firewall. It had turned it into projectiles. And those projectiles, under pressure of explosion, had ruptured many small pipelines, broken off instruments, destroyed control panels, and just created chaos down below the decks. And now oil was escaping all over the place. All the emergency response systems had been destroyed. There was nothing to stop the escalation of the fire. I talked about the divers. How could they possibly be anything to do with the escalation when they work under the water? The divers had been on Piper, period, for all the summertime every year for about 10 years because the jacket was so poorly constructed. They were making essential repairs, but they could only do so during the night. They had a huge dive spread, dive bell, decompression chamber, workshop, office, all temporarily placed on the lower deck. That temporary placement had become permanent, and they'd asked for a rubber mat about the size of this stage to be placed down across the gratings so they didn't have the uncomfortable walking on the grating in the rubber foot suits. To avoid slipping, they had put occupational safety ahead of process safety. That mat was now acting as a gathering and containment area for all the escaping gas, all the escaping oil. That mat was directly below the tartan riser. Effectively, there was a pool fire superheating the pipeline that was under pressure and caused the rupture. Competence. Believe it or not, the fire pumps were turned to manual every summer evening for half the day. The OIM, the installation manager, had agreed to do so because he felt that if the pumps were to start automatically, it may compromise the diver's safety. Makes sense. Except if you think about process safety and you put your fire pumps on manual for half your day shift when most people are in their beds, it's a failed decision. As a result of the first explosion, you could not access the fire pumps. So on that night, not one drop of fire water or deluge fell on Piper Alpha because the pumps would never start. Communication. Despite being able to see, Piper Alpha was in severe distress. You could see the flames for 30 miles away. The OIMs on Tartan and Claymore continued to pump oil and gas into their pipelines because they were waiting to be told to stop. It gets me to a point about stop intervention and control of work. You must ensure that all your people on your installations and your work sites understand they have the power to shut down if they feel that they are compromised. On Piper, because they had suffered earlier explosions, etc., they had developed a feeling of it'll never happen on here. We have recovered from explosions. We've recovered from fires. We're resilient. We were all complacent, including myself. And lastly, to stop production, to still be pressurising these pipes when you know there's a hydrocarbon release of significance elsewhere has to be a huge failure in judgment. I am now swimming away my best as I can to be picked up by a supply ship. That supply ship had seen us jump, but we didn't appreciate it. And if you can imagine looking up as you're trying to swim away on the surface of the sea and you see a towering vessel in front of you, you think you're done. This is your last opportunity and you're going under. Once again, I was faced with the fact or the thought that I'm going to die tonight, but this time it's going to be under the vessel. Thankfully, they had seen us jump and they were effecting a rescue. They came alongside. How did that rescue look? I had hypothermia. I was in the North Sea. They threw me a rope and asked me to hold on to it. I could barely stop shaking. I had no control. Tried a couple of times, and eventually I wrapped the rope around my waist and I held my arms tight, and they dragged me out of the water, and I was violently shaking with the cold, hypothermia. The crew immediately dragged me down below deck, stripped off my coveralls. They were heading me into the showers to try and warm up, and I saw the most perfect sight of a naked man standing in the showers. Vince had been survived. He'd been rescued. We stood in that shower, cuddling like two children. We did so for 15 seconds, no longer. Honestly. And what I won't tell you, well, I will share with you, Vince is about 5 foot nothing, and I'm 6 foot two. Those pictures would have been gold. Anyway, I get dried and I go up onto the ship's bridge. And before doing so, what woke me and Vince up to reality was two other survivors had been pulled in from the same ship crew. They were less fortunate than Vince and I. They had horrific burns, broken bones, things that were life-changing. You could hear them bawling and squealing. And those noises will stay with me forever. I went up onto the bridge of the ship. I asked to make a phone call. I wanted to tell my next of kin that I was coming home, because I knew many would not be. The skipper of the ship wasn't too keen on letting me use the phone. He was too busy. But eventually he did. I made that phone call to my mother, of all people. That's a different story. She never talked about that, God bless her. I put down the phone on the bridge and I turned around, and this is what I saw. The third explosion, another 18-inch pipeline exploding, full rupture. The heat was so intense from the blast that the paint peeled off the bulkheads on that vessel some 250 metres away. That's what a disaster feels like. That's why we have to do what we have to do. Because it's important that we don't compromise. I'm going to go back to that slide right now, because this is a short video. It's about 2 minutes long. It's about the human cost of Piper Alpha. I want you to take note of some of these things. Take note of those that escaped, what they had to do. And I would wish that none of you have to experience the same.
A total of 61 of the personnel of Piper survived the event. Their evidence was heard at the inquiry. In the light of that evidence, it can be seen that they escaped from the platform in the following ways. 27 descended by rope from the 68-foot level to the 20-foot level. 7 climbed down a rope or hose from the 68-foot level or a navigation platform below it and dropped into the sea. 5 jumped off the 68-foot level or the platform just below. 1 jumped off a roof beside the drilling derrick. 15 jumped off at the level of the pipe deck, 131 feet. And 5 jumped off at the level of the heli deck, 175 feet. Sixteen of the deceased from Piper were recovered from the surface of the sea. 38 were recovered from the seabed. And 81 were recovered from inside the accommodation. 30 persons from Piper remain missing and should be presumed to have died on the 6th of July as a result of the disaster. 2 members of the crew of the Sandhaven's fast rescue craft also died.
Think of the ripple effect of 167 deaths. Communities, families, friends, work colleagues, it's endless. All grieving, And remember what he said, grief never leaves us. We learn to live with it, or it breaks us till we go. Every one of those 167 lives were as tragic as the other. I often think about the 81 in the accommodation. They went to where they were told to go. They were relying on the systems to keep them safe and to allow them to escape. Except on Piper, that was never going to happen. The installation manager, who sadly lost his life as well, was completely overwhelmed by the situation. It's not because he wasn't trained or hadn't attended the courses, but it's not about training, let me tell you that. So if you're selling training at the trades sessions across there, start talking about assurance, competence assurance. Because on Piper, everybody had the right tickets. They had the right training courses, qualifications. But when it came to emergency preparedness, they never practiced. They did not practice. If you were going to do a drill on Piper Alpha or a muster, it would be on a Sunday at 4 o'clock if the weather was reasonable. Does that prepare you for a disaster or an incident? I can assure you it does not. So start talking about assurance and not training. Competence assurance is one of the most important things you can ever do for people that work in dangerous situations. Those 81 did as was told. The vast majority of the people that died, the 167 that died, only a few died of burns. Most of them died of smoke inhalation or heat stress. I tell you that because if your accommodation is supposed to be your safe haven and the doors don't close properly and your deluge doesn't work and you have no assurance around your escape systems, you will fail. This was all that was left in the morning. In fact, it was like this by midnight. 2/3 of that installation had melted into the sea. The only part that remained above was the drilling module, the wellhead module. And why? Because the cement in the wells had made it all that more strong. That installation would have still been standing today, quite safely. 36 cement conductors is a lot of support. But Occidental wanted to have it removed from site. It was a scab on the company. So as soon as the accommodation module was retrieved in October that year, they toppled the installation and made it all disappear so they could build a replacement 1 mile away. And they did so within 5 years, Piper B. I'm not going to do this slide today because it's for a different audience, but it's about the iceberg of ignorance when you don't communicate or you don't understand how to communicate properly as an organisation. It's for another day.
In my consider...
going to play this video as we move towards the close. The Piper Alpha was such a huge disaster, it was subject to a public inquiry. The head of the public inquiry, Lord Cullen, did a fantastic job. He highlighted 103 recommendations that were completely accepted by many, many governments and industries. I believe Canada accepted many of them. This next video, again a short video, is Lord Cullen giving his professional opinion on the commitment of Occidental management.
In my considered opinion, Occidental can have been in no doubt as to the grave consequences for the platform and its personnel in the event of a prolonged high-pressure gas fire. A memo dated the 18th of March 1988 stated that structural integrity could be lost within 10 to 15 minutes if a fire was fed from a large pressurized hydrocarbon inventory. A property loss prevention report to Occidental dated the 14th of October 1986 commented on the pipelines to and from the platform. Further, in 1987, Occidental's loss prevention department prepared a preliminary report which described various scenarios which could weaken the platform's structural steel support members and the means of firefighting in each case. One of these was an oil or gas riser rupture. In the case of a rupture on the pipeline side of the emergency shutdown valve, the ESV, no direct action could be taken on the platform to stem the flow of hydrocarbon. These passages, from reports to Occidental themselves, could be used to describe what happened in the disaster.
Let me summarize just one of those points. Occidental had had pre-warning in the late 80s about how vulnerable their installation was. They had commissioned their own internal loss adjusters to go and visit the installation to prepare a report on its vulnerability. There was a young graduate engineer involved. He prepared and compiled a meticulous report that Lord Cullen refers to. He submitted it to management onshore. They commended him for his efforts. It was a very insightful report. But they also said, yeah, it's a great report, but he really doesn't know how it is on Piper. He's a young engineer. He knows what he sees, but not how it operates. He's seen it worst-case scenario, and they chose to do nothing. Months later, what that young engineer had written in his report is exactly what happened on the night of the 6th of July, 1988. They lost a main production line, and it all came home to haunt them. So my message to you is, if you have new people to your installation or to your workplace, or you have young people graduating up, if they're courageous enough to ask you questions and to challenge the status quo, please don't dismiss them. Take what they say as an opportunity to learn. Be gracious. Thank them for it, because that's how they'll ask more questions, if they're met with a warm and welcoming response. If you shout them down, dismiss them, their heads will be down. You have lost opportunities to learn. This is just a summary. I've used these six C's to demonstrate what happened on the 6th of July, 1988. I really don't want you to waste this opportunity. This is not intended to replace any of your management systems or your protocols. It's intended to sit above it all. It's a mindset. It's a cultural building block. Feel free to use it. I certainly did as a senior manager. And it all gets back to this. You're free to choose, but you're never free from the consequences of your choices. Remember that when you leave this wonderful conference, if you take nothing else away, take away the fact that your choices can affect the livelihoods and lives of others. I encourage you to make your choices that the lives of your loved ones, your children, your family, and your colleagues depend upon them, and you will make them differently. I thank you for your time. We can go to Q&A. Thank you.
Well, we don't have a lot of time for Q&A. But I do have a couple of questions. What happened to Occidental? Did anything, any repercussions?
Occidental had no official comeuppance. They built Piper B, and within 18 to 24 months, they sold it, and they left the North Sea unscathed.
So no charges?
No charges.
Wow.
They effectively pinned responsibility on two of the contractors.
Okay.
And that's the way it went.
And it sounds like your life was saved due to a gut feeling that you shouldn't go through that door, you shouldn't go into your living quarters. How important is your gut in situations like this?
Well, on that situation, it was everything for me, and I just knew, and I think we've all had that feeling when we know something isn't right, whether that be at home, whether that be about on the road. Sometimes you have to run with this, you know, and I think that's why I did that night, and so did many others. Eventually, they realised it was beyond process, and they just had to make their own way off.
I know this is back in the 80s, but did you seek help? Did you get help? Obviously, that's a pretty traumatic incident that you had to live through.
So we are going back many years, and I think that's important. Back then, I can tell you there was no such thing as mental health counselling and so on for workers. I actually felt, I think I mentioned earlier on, that if I dared to challenge that I wasn't well, I would be scarred, I would be marked as unemployable. And at 26, with a potential family arriving, it wasn't something I was prepared for. Others went for counselling. And eventually I got to that place where I went, I was encouraged to go, although I felt I was good enough. And when I went into that room where many of those that had survived and those that had lost were just trying to console each other, it was a broken room of people. And I kind of knew if I placed myself in that place, it would bring me down. So I chose not to go down that route. But thankfully, the industry has moved on so far with mental health awareness, well-being awareness, and I think we are in a much better place. But a lot of that in the UK certainly came out of Piper Alpha, that what do we do with people when they're broken or they've suffered? And we are in a better place now.
A couple of questions from our audience. What's the significance of your company's name?
Oh, okay, so that could be a long answer, but I'll give you a short one because I know time is tight.
Yes.
We created Fortitude, and I say we, Marianne sitting at the table over there. Marianne actually did work on Grenfell. Grenfell was the UK's worst high-rise disaster. And she had to have a company name to work in that place, doing some cultural and safety work. And Fortitude stands for courage. And we felt, Marianne in particular, felt that courage was what was needed for people to speak up. So our message is, through our company name, never be afraid to share your concerns. And the action beyond compliance part quickly is, if you think your regulator, regardless of the country you're in, sets you regulations to keep you safe, don't go there. They set you a very low bar because it has to meet many people's needs. Action beyond compliance is what you should always strive for. If you aim for above compliance, you will comply more often than you do right now. And that's where Fortitude Action of Beyond Compliance came from.
All right, let's go with the last question. The one that has been voted on the most was an ESD available that would have shut down the entire platform?
The control room where the ESD was, all the emergency shutdowns, that's what ESD is, was completely compromised in the first explosion. They lost all functionality and had no means to shut down the installation. They pressed the button. Clearly it didn't work. But it's because the control room was completely lost in the first explosion.
Thanks, Steve.
That's all right. Thank you very much for your time. Yeah.
You're going to be around, right?
Yes.
You're going to be around. So I know that there were more questions. He's going to be around. He's obviously a lovely gentleman who was willing to tell the story of, anything we can't, the worst thing most of us can ever even imagine. So thank you again, Steve. Appreciate that amazing presentation.
Okay, Steve Bray, here we are. Right here at Energy Safety Canada. You just came off the stage. I have to tell you, the story that you just shared with us is probably one of the most impactful stories that I've heard. And you're giving it to from a standpoint where you were there. Most of the times we get to hear stories where people talk about events that occurred, but they were not actually there. So your perspective on this is life-changing. When you look at this and you go around and talk about it, I know over 40 years at this point, how do you manage talking about this all the time and it doesn't have any kind of impact on you? I mean, in regards of, like, when I say that is, how do you maintain your emotions intact?
So I recall the first couple of times I shared this story, and I shared it as a manager inside my own organization, and it was very emotional, and I realized the impact on my employees, my crews, was so significant that I couldn't keep it to myself anymore. And I knew I had to overcome the emotional side. And thankfully, I'm a pretty resilient individual anyway. And even on stage today, I've got that feeling in my stomach that it's emotional. And you can probably tell from the reverberation in my voice that I'm talking about something that's still so very personal. And I genuinely think that's what captures the audience, is they feel the emotion in the room. I said at the beginning, you may not remember the words I used, but you'll remember how you felt.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the same for me. I remember how I feel. when I do this. And when I retired a few years ago, I didn't think I would do this anymore. But then I realized it's my why. I do this because people take something away from me.
But the way that you go through the journey, I mean, it's step by step of exactly what occurred. And for you to be able to maintain your, to manage your emotions is really what it is in regards to what you're going through. Do you feel like when you're going through these stories, you're reliving that experience every single time? Because it's you have a memory, but it's so graphic and vivid because you were there during the event itself.
Yeah, those memories I talk about, those situations I found myself in, are still very vivid. And I think that's what allows me to be so personal in sharing it. And it depends. Sometimes I'm in the room. I do this offshore on to much smaller crews. And you'll see grown men like myself breaking down, and that's what really gets me, because men are men and they're not very good with the feelings. Mm-hmm. But when they hear a story such as this, it just captures them. And it's a bit like that for myself, you know, because my mother said to me once, how can you talk about that? Mm-hmm. She couldn't talk about it today. But I think that's something I have to go get through if I want to continue to share this. And why do I want to share it? Because I think it makes a difference. It's about influence.
So let me ask a strange question. This is the second time you referenced your mother in the last hour, so I have to ask the question. Will you tell us what your mom said on the phone call?
Yeah, well, I'll give you an abridged version of it. So I'd been away from home. I'm living in my own apartment in the city center for 5 years, pre-Piper. And my mother brought myself and my four siblings up. My father died very suddenly at 42 years of age. So my mother brought up the four of us, five of us, from a very young age. And she had the resilience that was incredible. And I knew when I was on that ship getting ready to make a phone call, whoever I chose to phone had to be the right person. I could have phoned my girlfriend or my brother. And I thought, no, I'll get my mother. But the significance of that is, since my father died in 76, I think it was, my mother had taken two sleeping tablets every night and a cup of cocoa at 9 o'clock, and she was gone till 8 o'clock the next morning. I knew I was calling her at almost 11 o'clock in the evening. And she picked the phone up and I said, hello, Mum, it's Steve. And she said, no, if you want to speak to Steve, call back in 2 weeks' time because he's not here. And I said, no, Mum, it's actually Steve, it's on the phone. She said, well, why are you calling me? You're at your work. And I said, Mum, get out of bed, put your gown on, go downstairs, make yourself a cup of tea, and put the TV news on. And just let the family know I'm coming home tomorrow. And I put the phone down. That was the end of the conversation. The part I usually tell is my mother never talked about that until the day she parted, which was a few years ago now. And I think it's because it was just so emotionally charged. But I knew she was the right person to tell. Because if I told my girlfriend, she would have broken down. If I told my brother, he would have had to tell everyone else. So I felt, and I still do, it was a heavy burden to give my mother. But at least it was happy news. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. And of course, for just perspective purposes, people need to understand at this time, there is no cell phone. So it's not like you could have just called randomly at any particular point. Now, there was a few questions that you weren't able to get into because we had some time limitations inside of there. So I wanted to address some of them if you're okay with it. It says, this was an incredible, inspiring presentation. Thank you. How would you recommend that we make the same impact on our leaders to adjust the culture?
So what I've learned through my time as a senior executive, and I've headed up trades associations and all that good stuff, is leaders need to be someone you can relate to, someone who you can talk to and share anything with. But most importantly, leaders have to be able to be humble. And the other thing I say is, if you're in a leadership position in this business, you'll have had a story to tell, not maybe as dramatic as mine.
Mm-hmm.
Show your vulnerability. Engage your folks in language that they understand. Let them know you're a person and you've got their back. And you can only do so by showing your vulnerability. And I think by doing what I do, I'm exposing vulnerability that is obvious on the stage. But I've done this internally. And people, when I started doing that, I would go back out to visit an installation where I had folks on board. And they were so welcoming. They would come and go, Steve, let me come and show you this, let me do that. And I think that's what leadership has to be. It hasn't to be something that sits at the top. It has to be at a level where you can communicate through your entire organization in the language they want to use.
So when you look back at some of this stuff and you've seen how things have changed over the years, are we having the correct safety culture now? Are we going in the right direction? Or do you look at this and go, we're still kind of stagnant, we're just branding it differently?
So what, and I'm going to make specific reference to the UK North Sea area, we have been on a journey in the last 2.5 years. I headed up Step Change in Safety for 4 years before I retired. And we were on a journey to improve leadership skills and process safety. And we've created some very strong curriculums around exposing leaders to very challenging, because some leaders have the finance background, they all not understand the operation.
Right.
And what we've been successful in doing is integrating some really high impact training around process safety. And that's what you need to think about. Process safety is the thing, it really does have high impact. And the thing that struck me about your conference here, I've spent a couple of days here, is it appears here you're still talking about occupational safety mm-hmm. and training. And I've made a significant emphasis on the stage to stop talking about training and start talking about competence assurance. Right. And I think that's the difference. We're on that journey from the UK, and I think in my years in industry, UK has always been a leading light as a result of Piper Alpha and so on. And I think that's something is a takeaway for me for Energy Safety Canada. Start thinking about process safety rather than occupational safety and well-being. Process safety is so important, and we don't do enough at managing our leadership's abilities around how they communicate around process safety or understand it. And I think that's a huge learning for you guys here.
So when you start looking at that, is there one particular direction that you would say start looking at this in particular? Is there something that comes to mind?
So what I see, I do this not as a living, I do it in an ad hoc manner. Leaders need to understand the risks that the workers face. And they need to understand how important it is to make sure that they have good communication links with the workforce. So what we do is we typically see groups going with members of the workforce and supervise the crew to workshops and engaging with them firsthand. And that gives them two things. It gives them context from what it feels like for someone who picks the tools up, but it also allows the people who pick the tools up to get a feeling for their boss. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what you have to do first. You have to break down barriers. People might say, well, there's no barriers, but there are.
There are.
And they're cultural, and they're hierarchy barriers. But you can break them down by spending time with the folks.
Okay. Now, I have another question that came from the audience. It says, is there anyone in your family who went into the oil and gas industry?
Yeah, well, so this happened in 1988. I fixed my younger brother up to work in an Occidental installation in 89.
No.
My mother went. She was not happy. So he went in 89, and he's spent the rest of his career not on that platform. He moved around. All our five sons have worked offshore at some point in their lives. And we couldn't decide for them, but we made sure we communicated what it was all about. Mary Ann, my wife, worked offshore. Her second career was offshore. So our entire family has spent time offshore, and some still do.
Amazing, amazing just to hear. Now, and there's one more that I have here. It says, the Alpha disaster occurred at night. It has occasionally been referenced as a fatigue-related incident. Do you agree with this?
I completely disagree. That could have happened 5 hours earlier. And remember, there is no nighttime in the summer in Scotland.
Very good point. Now, there was a reference during the presentation that you talked about the person that had done portion of the reporting that was there that you had said that they said, ignore what he had to say. And then there was a reference there that he said that it was going to take 10 to 12 minutes for the structure to start collapsing. Is that almost in real time how it occurred while you were there?
I remember, I recall when I'd recovered most of my cognitive skills, mm-hmm. I was transferred onto a standby vessel, Pharos. And all we could see, because it was an open space, was this huge fire. You couldn't really see the installation because the flames were so intense, but you could hear it. And it was like cries for help from a huge metal. And you could hear it creaking and moaning as parts would slowly slip off. And eventually when the accommodation module went, it took a sizable part of the structure with it. So it literally disappeared within 40 minutes. It just disappeared.
Now, the way that we're doing this is we're going to be adding this into your presentation as we release this. If people want to find out more information about you, where can they go?
About me?
Yes.
I would suggest the on the last slide is my LinkedIn address.
Okay.
That's where I do most of my work. We have a company LinkedIn site that we don't, as retirees, we don't spend a lot of time in it.
Got it.
But if you go to my LinkedIn site, I have loads of sort of material in there.
Okay, well, Steve Ray, I really do appreciate you sharing the information with us here at Energy Safety Canada and we're here with our friends at Safety FM. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your time. Thank you.
The views and opinions expressed during this broadcast, podcast, or radio show are solely those of the host and guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Safety FM and or Radio Big. The content discussed, including examples of analysis, is provided for illustrative purposes only. It should not be applied as the sole solution in real-world scenarios, as it is based on limited and dated open source information. Any assumptions made during this broadcast, podcast, or radio show are not reflective of Safety FM and or Radio Big. No portion of this broadcast, podcast, or radio show may be reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form or by any means, electronic, mechanical, recording, or otherwise, without prior written permission of Safety FM and or Radio Big. For permission requests, please contact Safety FM or Radio Big directly. Radio Big directly.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.